Penguin Random House Audio presents Mud and Stars, Travels in Russia with Pushkin, Tolstoy, and Other Geniuses of the Golden Age. This is the author, Sarah Wheeler. Introduction. I travelled across 8 time zones, from rinsed northwestern beetroot fields to far eastern Arctic tundra, where Chukchi still hunt walrus, in a region the size of France that has no roads. I paddled through the cauldron of ethnic soot that is the Caucasus, where flashing epauletted Lermontov died in the aromatic air, and where sheaves of corn still stand like soldiers on a blazing afternoon, just like they do in Gogol's stories. I sunbathe fully clothed, even wearing a woolly hat, on the shore of fabled Lake Baikal, eating caviar with my fingers from a tub purchased at the fish market for 300 rubles, about $4.50. I went to writers' homes, one of the few things Russia does well, preserving them, I mean. I was at Turgenev's forest-buried estate of Spaskoi-Lutovinova in spring when the scent of dog rose hung on the breeze, bougainvillea tubercular on the walls. Turgenev complained in a letter that spring in Europe lacked the explosiveness of that season in Russia. I took the Trans-Siberian Railway in winter, crunching across snowy platforms to buy table tennis bats of dried fish from Babushki, and sailed the Black Sea in summer, where dolphins leapt in front of violet Abkhazian peaks. I was searching for a Russia not in the news, a Russia of common humanity and daily struggles, and my guides were writers of the Golden Age. Russia was the first foreign country I ever visited. I was 11. I've been looking over my shoulder at it ever since. Like many, I am enthralled to those writers, roughly Pushkin to Tolstoy, who continue to dominate world literature. It helped getting through them all to have spent a lot of time in the polar regions. Tolstoy's doorstops were made for whiteouts. I read War and Peace for the first time at the South Pole, looking through the plastic porthole of a tent at hundreds of miles of shimmering flat ice as 1,000 horses galloped over the plains at Borodino. The second time, many years later, I was stranded in another tent on the Greenland ice cap, and again Tolstoy's genius filled bright night whiteness. My aim in this book is to show how the best writers of the Golden Age, which I define, broadly, as the period between 1800 and 1910, represent their country, then and now. I followed 19th century footsteps in order to make connections. Authors mainly active from about 1890 to 1934 are generally thought to belong to the Silver Age, but as they don't feature in this book, I've stuck to the old-fashioned definition of the Golden Age, 1800 to 1910. The writers here are not a homogeneous group. One scholar says, Tolstoy tells us to give away our money. Dostoevsky tells us to go to church. Chekhov says, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. Gogol says, to hell with it. But they all deal with a fumbling search for certainties with which we all engage. And they're failures in one sense or another, as we all are. Tolstoy was obsessed with truth, but only told it in his novels. Dostoevsky, obsessed not with truth but with God, was a compulsive gambler. He pawned his watch so many times that his saintly second wife said she never knew what time it was. While each chapter of Mud and Stars is centred on a particular writer, or in two cases, a couple of writers, I have aimed at a flowing whole, not discrete essays. There are biographical pages. I always like to know about a writer's life, though I'm not particularly interested in tracing connections between life and work. Biography has no bearing on a reader's appreciation of books. It doesn't matter how much or how little you know about a life. Moscow and Petersburg are so unrepresentative of Russia that I avoided them as much as possible. They have always been unrepresentative. Alexander Sergeyevich Pushkin was born into the nobility in 1799. When French was the language of the cultured classes. Tens of millions of Russians, outside the two main cities, however, knew nothing of European influences, just as 140 million today know nothing of oligarchical bling. their lives were and are consumed with the generally dreadful business of being Russian. I cherish the old-fashioned ideal that government can play a role, enhancing the lives of its citizens without threatening civil liberties, allowing individuals the maximum space to live and flourish as they choose. I saw nothing of this in Russia. Mostly in my travels, I used homestays. I spent many months in fourth-floor 1950s apartments with windowless bathrooms, sprawled on sofas with my hosts, watching television, my new friends bent over devices, moaning about Ukraine. I remember lifting the curtain and peeping from a sofa bed in Irkutsk in Siberia at 6 in the morning to see people scurrying to work through snow, in darkness illuminated by the annunciatory glow of the few street lamps that worked. Heads down, shoulders hunched. I wrote this book at a time of deteriorating relations between the West and Russia. Nationalism had besieged the country. People I stayed with or met on trains had no illusions about the kleptocracy under which they lived. But as we watched flickering images of Putin bending a piece of metal with his bare hands or spearing an emperor-sized fish, the prevailing attitude was, yes, he's a monster, but he's our monster. Almost everyone felt that the West was out to get them, and in the light of that, at least Putin was batting for Russia. The country's GDP at that time was approximately equal to that of Italy, a country with just over a third of the population of Russia and under a 50th of the landmass. Russia emerged as an increasingly shocking country. It is in the grip of a murderous dictatorship. The leadership stinks at every level, if people can stink at levels, which I think they can. But what about the ones who aren't leaders, or rich, or powerful? I resolved to give them a voice, in my small way. You'll hear them in these pages. I wrote about what I saw and heard, or tried to. Along the way, I learned Russian, at least well enough to read a Chekhov story in the original, and indeed read the master's underappreciated travel writing. At the inn where I was staying, the maid, when giving me a spoon, wiped it against her backside. But I never dreamed in Russian. I've learned a few languages, and that's when you know you've got it. I also pursued some topics for fun, and I include them here for the same reason. I tried to learn to cook Russian dishes, for example, and went to concert halls to hear Russian songs. I hope that besides the fun, these themes contribute to an amateur sketch of a country which is lovable despite it all. There is no such thing as the Russian soul, or perhaps even Russian culture. It's too big a country, 1/6 of the Earth's landmass, and it's too diverse and too socially divided. Catherine the Great said it was too big to govern, or so they say she said. Once I'd been in the polar north and the Caucasian south, I saw that for myself. The books discussed in these pages engage not with that chimera, but with the complexity of human experience. There is a Russian literal landscape and its emotional counterpart. I worked on the project with great pleasure for 2 years, until a crisis overtook my personal life. I became a former writer. When I eventually roused myself after a couple more years and decided life might be worth living, I returned to my Russian notes, of which I had hundreds and hundreds of pages, and my shelves of annotated books. Rereading it all, I met myself coming back. These pages give form to the vanished years. I was in the mud, and my writers were the stars. Books have been kinder to me than life. I have attempted to show how I've appropriated the volumes mentioned in these pages into my own life. All literature is a dialectic. The same goes for my stabs at cooking Russian food and so on. I was trying to absorb as much as I could. The writers you'll find between these covers made wonderful companions. They kept me pretty cheerful. When I was writing about Dostoevsky, I told one of my Russian teachers that I found him and his work a balm. She raised an eyebrow at such a description of that messianic, tortured xenophobe and genius. But Dostoevsky wrote about human mutuality and about taking responsibility.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?